the Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We're well into the holiday season, and we're already feasting on some of the most delicious foods we know. For many of us, chocolate will be on the list. So we thought it appropriate to discuss the history of chocolate with historian Marcy Norton. Norton is completing a new book on the subject titled Tobacco and Chocolate, From Sacred Goods to Secular Commodities. Following our lesson on the history of chocolate, Fiona Beattie will join us to tell us about a museum devoted to that subject, and Michael Farquhar will offer up another segment in his 10-part series drawn from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at a few items of historical interest in the news that you may have missed. We have three brief items in the news to report this week. First, Alotta Aquiano's famous first-person account of the Middle Passage in his 1789 autobiography, The Interesting Narrative of the Life of Alotta Aquiano, has become the definitive version of the harrowing journey endured by slaves transported across the Atlantic. The problem is, he may not have made the journey. According to Vincent Coretta, who is writing a biography of Aquiano, Aquiano appears to have been born in South Carolina, not Africa. Needless to say, researchers anxiously await Coretta's book, which threatens a pillar of scholarship on slave narratives and the African diaspora. Two historians are suing the publishers of Dan Brown's best-selling thriller, The Da Vinci Code. Richard Lee and Michael Bagent are suing Random House for lifting the whole architecture of the research that went into their 1982 nonfiction book, The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail. The trial is set to start in February 2006. The Hollywood film on Brown's book is scheduled for release in May. And finally, I guess it was inevitable, we now have another in the series of idiot guides, this one devoted to Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln's story has been told many times, including several interviews and commentaries on Talking History. Well, now you can learn more about the man the easy way in The Complete Idiot's Guide to the Legacy of Lincoln, written by Pamela Oldham and Meredith Bean McMath, and published by Alpha Books. Each chapter opens with an outline of what will be covered and ends by recapping the basics under the heading, The Least You Need to Know. Oldham explained the book this way. I've written this for people who want to know more about Lincoln without having to slog through a thick academic book. Once they've tasted the breadth that is offered in my book, they'll want to delve further into it. Kim Bauer, curator of the historical collection at Illinois' Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, was more cautious in her assessment. It's a very good starting point, she commented. The problem is that you have to worry about people taking this as the be-all and end-all. Once I've got this done, I know all I need to know about Lincoln. When we return, I discuss the history of chocolate with Marcy Norton. This is Talking History. From time to time over the years, we've taken up the fascinating and important history of various foods and drinks. We do so again this week, taking a look at the history of one of our favorite foods, chocolate. Our guest, Marcy Norton, a professor in the Department of History at George Washington University, is finishing a book titled Tobacco and Chocolate, From Sacred Goods to Secular Commodities. Welcome, Marcy.
Thank you.
Where did chocolate originate?
Well, it's actually a harder question to answer than you might imagine. The easy answer is that it originated in Central America or possibly Northern South America, and there is firm evidence of it existing about several centuries BC among the early Mayan cultures. And what makes it a hard question to answer is that cacao, from which chocolate comes in its native form, is indigenous to Northern South America, where there wasn't any cacao being grown for chocolate production at the time of the conquest, and yet it was in Mexico. So people don't know whether it was originally used in South America and then brought into Mexico and Central America, or whether there was an earlier history that we just haven't been able to find.
Okay, interesting. Well, assuming wherever it was prepared for the first time, how was it actually prepared, or what do we know about how it was prepared by Native Americans?
Well, many of the different cultures that lived in what we call Mesoamerica, so the most famous ones being Maya and Aztec, used cacao in chocolate beverages. So beverage was the primary form it was consumed, not the only way. And it was ground up with a number of different additives. Dictionaries from the colonial period will list about five different names under the term cacao, meaning that there are at least five different drinks. So some of them would be mixed with maize or corn and different kinds of corn, some more like a porridge and some of it roasted. And then also important kinds of spices. The one most familiar to all of us is vanilla, but also other kinds that we only know by the Nahuatl and the Spanish translated names today. And also they would often add honey as well to give it a sweetening effect.
Okay, you mentioned liquid, and let me pick up on that a bit, because you also write, and I found this very interesting, that chocolate was associated with a life force originating from or strengthened by its blood-red coloring. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a very important symbolic association in many Mesoamerican cultures in different kinds of ways. The cacao pod itself, from which cacao beans come from, was likened to be like a heart. So the parallelism began there. And then when chocolate was prepared, one of the spices that they added was what we know as Akiato or Anato today, which imparts a reddish color. The flavor is sort of musky. Sometimes it's likened to being saffron-ish. And so with that red color, then it was seen to have this symbolic cognate status with blood. And also because of the kind of uplifting, stimulating effects that are associated with drinking chocolate, that was where the idea of this kind of force came from. And there was different kinds of iconographic and ritual ways that this congruence between a life force and chocolate was recognized in Mesoamerican societies.
Well, not being much of a cook, because it's the first I've heard of Akiato, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, that added the color and also a certain, you said, saffron taste?
You know, like with any substance, it has its own distinct flavor. It's still used today in Mexican cuisine, sometimes as a coating for fish and other sorts of things. And it has, yeah, a slightly earthy kind of flavor, as well as the very distinctive hue that made the chocolate the preferred way of drinking for Mesoamericans.
Okay. Associated with life force then, and sort of related to blood red coloring. But you also write that the consumption of chocolate in Native America, Mesoamerica, was associated with status and the privileges of status. How did this come about?
Well, again, there's different kinds of evidence for this association, but there's also some ambiguity as well. We have quotes from Spanish chroniclers who are describing the customs of the conquered Aztecs, and some of them say explicitly that chocolate was only a privilege of the elite, and the elite meaning people who were celebrated warriors and wealthy merchants, perhaps, and people who descended from royal dynasties, and that commoners were not allowed to consume it. Other evidence is a little bit more ambiguous and suggests that it was mostly consumed by elite, but that under special occasions and opportunities, maybe everyone would have the privilege of drinking it. And there's also some sort of famous quotations from the Aztec emperor saying that the warriors who came back victorious from their various battles would be rewarded with lovely flowers and fragrant chocolate. So suggesting that, again, it was special privilege that was giving to those deserving of it for either their birthright or their accomplishments.
And that would include visiting dignitaries, I think you
Yes,
wrote.
That was a sort of standard court protocol in the Aztec Empire, that when people from neighboring kingdoms or city-states would come, or even sometimes their tributaries, part of their reception, the formal reception they would receive would be presentations of cups of chocolate. And also when there would be merchant meetings. Long-distance merchants would congregate together, and they too would have part of their, if you could think of it, sort of a fancy business meeting, had to be accompanied by these cups of chocolate as well.
You mentioned merchants. You also write in your book that chocolate was occasionally used as currency. Is that connected in some way?
Well, again, it was, first of all, that cacao beans themselves had exchange value among the different cultures of Mesoamerica, who otherwise were quite different from each other, spoke different languages, were often at war with one another, but they were united in their love of chocolate and thus in their common appreciation for cacao. So it was both a useful way to, since it preserves well and they're easy to carry, it functioned conveniently as currency. And also because it was something that was esteemed among different groups, they could mutually appreciate it and use it that way. And I might add incidentally that the Spanish, even for a while, played with the idea of adopting that as a kind of currency that they could use in Europe because they were having trouble with the debasing value of currency there.
Okay, let me be clear for myself here. We're talking about exchanging the beans themselves. I ask that because is there any indication that chocolate was prepared differently depending upon where you were in Mesoamerica?
Well, again, it's hard to answer that with as much precision as we'd like because the evidence is so often Spanish chroniclers' reports on things that happened many years before, and the archaeological evidence doesn't get detailed in that way. But my understanding is that on the one hand, there was a kind of standard kinds of recipes that were prepared that were pretty common throughout the Americas. For instance, the descriptions that are in the Nahuatl Spanish dictionaries compared to the dictionaries that are Spanish Zapotec, which is the Oaxacan language, or Spanish Mayan, actually look a lot like each other. They have different names because the languages are different, but the ingredients are common. But having said that, I'm sure it's like today, maybe we have a recipe that's like, let's say, macaroni and cheese that everyone understands when you say that it is, but each family or individual might have it sort of individual way of doing it so that there's variation within these common preparations.
Okay. Before we leave Native Americans, you also mentioned it was consumed ritually at betrothals and wedding ceremonies. Was this just because it was a special drink, such as champagne for us today, or did it have some symbolic meaning for those events?
I think it did have some added symbolic meaning. Again, to refer back to both the connections with blood and the kind of idea of life force, it made it a fitting accompaniment to the merger of two families who are, in a sense, combining their blood and having connotations of sexuality as well with the life force and so on, made it seem particularly appropriate for that reason. So even beyond its celebratory character, I think that's why you find it in those settings.
Okay. Europeans, when did they first encounter chocolate?
Well, the very first encounter that we know about is actually with cacao beans rather than chocolate itself. And that happened on Columbus's fourth voyage in 1502 when they were sailing off the coast of Honduras and they encountered a Mayan trading canoe and they kidnapped the people in it and took the cargo, and included in the cargo were things that Columbus's son later described as being like almonds, and the way that the occupants of the canoe treated them as if they were their eyeballs that had fallen out, that they were so valued. So that was their first encounter, but not having any sense of what you would do with these almond-like beans and that it was the basis for the beverage. So the first time that they really encountered it in its full use was when Cortez arrived with 600 men in Veracruz in 1519 and began their journey, which would be eventually to Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital, and came into contact with different Mayan and Aztec groups. And as part of their diplomatic encounters, they too would be offered servings of chocolate. And of course, we don't know about all of them, but there's a few accounts that came down about those meetings where they were offered chocolate.
Do we know what their reaction was, say, to the taste of what they were given?
The best early account comes from a report of a Spanish missionary who interviewed Indians about the conquest later on. So it was many, many years after the fact, but if we can believe it, he describes how these envoys from Moctezuma, who was then the ruler of Tenochtitlan, the Aztec Empire, came and were ready to meet with these strange bearded visitors from somewhere else. And in their fashion, they presented them with gifts and also these cups of chocolate. And the Spaniards were very excited about the gifts, you know, always happy to see gold and precious looking jewels. But when it came to the chocolate, they were very nervous about it because they had never seen it before. And they had to first have the Indians drink it themselves to be reassured that it wasn't some kind of nasty or poisonous potion. And then they drank it themselves. And in his account, he says that they found it to be refreshing, but I don't know if that actually reflects the views of the Spanish at that moment, or rather the writer's later appreciation for chocolate, because other accounts we have of the first meetings with chocolate is that the Spaniards found it quite repulsive, that they found the taste really nasty and that the look of it itself was pretty repugnant to them.
Okay, let me take on that last point a bit, because saying it's repulsive, the general take is that because of that, Europeans really had to change the taste in order to accept it. But you don't seem to go along with that in your book.
Right. That's true. That's one of my major arguments. The standard line, is, as you mentioned, is that the Europeans had to change it to suit their taste. And the most famous way that they changed it was with the addition of sugar and eliminating these, what for them would seem like these odd spices, like chili peppers and other flowery spices as well. But what I found is that in the earliest imports that we have of chocolate arriving into Europe, and also the treatises that talk about it, they are using exactly the same ingredients that the Mesoamericans were using. The same Nahuatl spices are mentioned. Even maize is being mixed in with it. And they do start using sugar, which is an innovation. But my argument is that it's not quite as innovative as it might seem, because the Mesoamericans were already using honey. And the step from honey to sugar is really not such a big one. I mean, the idea of sweetening was already in place. So they do make changes gradually, but it's not because they find the initial taste repulsive. Once they do have enough contact with it, they acquire the taste for it in its full Mesoamerican manner.
We only have time for one last question. So let me ask you this. If you look at it from today's perspective and look back at what it was like when it was first imported or brought into Europe, any vestiges of chocolate's pre-modern or pre-Columbian past remain, or is it just an entirely different commodity at this point?
I think there are several vestiges. Maybe the most obvious one to us is its continued associations with romantic love, and the idea of it being, you know, Valentine's Day and even an aphrodisiac is related to its earliest usages in marriage ceremonies and betrothals. At the same time, I think even the practice of putting marshmallows on top of chocolate might be related, because the Mesoamerican way of making chocolate was to create this foamy cap to it. So there would be these bubbles on top. And I think maybe marshmallows on top of hot chocolate is the legacy of the practice of having foam on it as well.
Interesting. We're going to get any recipes with the book?
Yes, of course.
Very good. We'll look forward to that. Okay. Thank you, Marcy, for joining us.
Thank you.
This is great fun. My guest has been Marcy Norton, professor of history at George Washington University and the author of the forthcoming book, Tobacco and Chocolate, From Sacred Goods to Secular Commodities. This is Talking History.
Kit Kats. Crunch. Instant satisfaction. Familiar and all expectations fulfilled. Nostalgia in chocolate. Let's share them out on the steps. Teasers, crumbly and fun, rich and honey flavoured, bubbles and crumbles, chalky bits and mores, floating and sliding around, drifting, drifting through chocolate bubbles.
As you've just heard in my conversation with Marcy Norton, Europeans had no knowledge of chocolate until they arrived in the Americas. In 1519, Bernal Diaz de Castile, who was a member of Hernan Cortes' invading force of Spaniards, described his first encounter with it during a meal with Aztec Emperor Montezuma. First of all, the kinds that the country produced were laid before him. He ate very little, but from time to time, a liquor prepared from cocoa, and of an aphrodisiac nature, as we were told, was presented to him in golden cups. I observed a number of jars, about 50, brought in, filled with foaming chocolate, of which he took some. Fiona Beattie joins us now to tell us about a museum devoted to this wonderful food.
Caramels are only a fad. Chocolate is a permanent thing. Prescient words uttered by Milton Hershey, founder of Hershey Chocolate Company, 1903. Chocolate, as we have heard, has been celebrated and enjoyed by humankind for centuries. Our lexicon now includes the word chocoholic, and we can even buy gourmet chocolate in clothing departments, a one-stop shop. And there's a museum for everything. The Chocolate Museum in St. Stephen, Canada's chocolate town, and as of 2000, that's official, opened in 1999. The picturesque small town in New Brunswick, Canada, owes its title Chocolate Town to the candy company of brothers James and Gilbert Ganong, who began their enterprise in the late 1800s. Located in what was the original Ganong Candy Factory building, the museum offers hands-on exhibits, interactive computer displays that explain how today's chocolate and candies are made, along with antique candy-making equipment and historic chocolate boxes. Empty, I presume. The website provides a short history of chocolate and details how the entrepreneurial brothers Ganong were the first to use cellophane packages, and that they invented and produced the first chocolate nut bar in North America, the first 5-cent chocolate bar in 1910, and in 1932, the first heart-shaped box containing chocolate. To find out for yourself, go to chocolatemuseum.ca.
And finally, we continue our series of readings from Michael Farquhar's new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. Farquhar is a writer and editor for The Washington Post, and this week he selected a piece from Part 6 of his book, Fantastic Forgeries and Literary Frauds, which he's titled A Thin Vermeer.
The great Dutch artist Jan Vermeer wasn't known for his religious-themed paintings, but his forger was. Beginning in 1936, Hans van Meegeren, another Dutchman, painted 6 biblical scenes in the style of the master and passed them off as original. The art world trembled with excitement. Museums snatched up the newly discovered, completely bogus Vermeers, and van Meegeren got rich. It all backfired, though, when a Nazi art aficionado obtained his own supposedly lost work. Van Meegeren was an honorary sort of fellow, a drug-addled artist with a point to prove and little to lose. Frustrated by years of his dismissive reviews, he set out to humiliate his critics in the most spectacular way possible. What resulted was a meticulously produced forgery he called Christ and the Disciples at Emmaus. Van Meegeren took an original 17th century painting and stripped it to the canvas. He recreated Vermeer's colors with materials the masters used, like white lead, lapis lazuli, and crushed insect shells. Then, with a mixture of chemicals added, he baked the work to give it the appearance of age. Finally, he concocted a fake provenance for the painting and foisted it on to the unsuspecting art world. The critics were awed. The forger no doubt relished them blathering on breathlessly about the Italian influence on the picture and other such empty analyses. But the temptation he must have felt to reveal the hoax and thus embarrass his enemies was tempered somewhat by an unexpected windfall. A group of investors actually raised money to buy the fake Vermeer for a fortune. Christ and the Disciples at Emmaus went on display at the Boymans Museum in the Netherlands and stayed there for 7 years. Van Meegeren quickly graduated from making a point to the far more lucrative business of minting other imitation Vermeers. Works like The Last Supper, with the figure of John copied rather amateurishly from the original Girl with the Pearl Earring, made lots of money for Van Meegeren. But when Nazi Field Marshal Hermann Göring got his hands on another fake, Christ and the Adulteress, the deception turned dangerous. At the end of World War II, the painting was discovered among the thousands of artworks Göring had looted from German-occupied territories across Europe and traced back to Van Meegeren. He was arrested and charged by the Dutch government with the capital crime of collaboration with the enemy. To save himself, Van Meegeren admitted he had forged Göring's painting and other fakes as well. The presiding judge was skeptical, but allowed the prisoner the opportunity to prove himself. With the court closely watching, Van Meegeren created the Young Christ teaching at the temple, using the same techniques he had applied to his other forgeries. The result was incontrovertible, and the charges of collaboration were dropped. Van Meegeren was instead convicted of forgery and sentenced to 1 year in prison. He died soon after, while the experts still reeled. "It is unbelievable that it fooled me," remarked one. "A psychologist could explain it better than I can."
You've been listening to Michael Farquhar reading from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds, published by Penguin Books. That's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.